problems, two of which were simply problems that we had. One was not publicly noticing them on the correct time, so we've corrected that. One was for not collecting the exact fee. We've corrected that. And the third was with a problem with some confusion over interpretation of statute, but we've also corrected that in regulation, so I don't think there needs to be any statutory changes.
I don't think there's anybody else here to testify. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one question and one comment. Mr. Burns, on the fiscal note, we show zero fiscal note with the analysis saying funding for the board is included in the department's operating budget request. Do you have any information that indicates how much this particular board costs within the department request?
Mr. Chairman, last year, FY88, the revenue was $171,000, and the expenditures for the board was $150,000. So there was an excess of revenues of $20,000.
Okay. Could you just see that we get I'd like to have a copy of that page.
Sure.
I'll just clip it to this.
Okay.
Someone comes to floor vote. The other is a letter. I received a letter from a constituent who is a hairdresser, and I don't have the letter with me. It's been a while, but I could probably pull it out of the file. But it has to do with the procedure for the examination. She was raising some concerns about it. I don't remember the specifics, but who would I contact to see and just to pass on those concerns to see if they're valid and resolve them?
You could either contact myself or the licensing examiner supervisor, but her name is Barbara Branson. Either one of those people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, further questions? Is there anybody else here to testify on this? Okay. What's the will of the committee? The chair would entertain a motion to move the bill within the recommendations.
So
okay. Any objection? Hearing no objection, motion carries. Finally, you might as well stay there, huh, for veterinarians.
Right.
Bill 96.
Again, Mr. Chairman, there was the legislative audit raised one issue, which was having to do with the failure of the board to really license veterinary technicians. We have statutory authority to do that and through regulation, but the board has really never actively licensed or become involved in licensing veterinary technicians. And it was the recommendation of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee that the board should consider doing that. And in fact, at the veterinarian's next meeting, this matter will be on their agenda for their. And I've talked to all of them. I don't think they're opposed to considering taking that action.
These people start talking about how stupid the legislature is at their meetings. last year, they caught them on tape saying, well, we can just propose this, and they won't know the difference. They're really stupid about that. They sent us some legislation, and we had them on tape saying that about the legislation.
Who said that?
The veterinarian.
Well, that's...
Actually, though, the Legislative Audit and Audit Committee found that they do serve an important public purpose, and we would urge that the board be reestablished.
Mr. Chairman, you remember the first question that I asked last time on the other board?
Yes.
The same one, just if you could identify the cost, the revenues, and the expenditures, please.
One on the record, which I just sent it to
you.
Sure.
Just tell me now and then see if I get a copy of it.
Chairman, I am taking this out of the performance report, and you may have it in your files to be able to send you a copy. For the Board of Examiners, the revenue for FY88 was $9,000. The expenditures were $30,000, so there was a deficit in this case of $20,000.
Let me maybe we want to hold this over until we find out how much was the deficit?
$20,000.
Is the department thinking about adjusting their fees?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, probably not, as board currently pays $100, which is pretty typical of a renewal fee for most of these professions. And again, what we try to do is we do a balancing act. You will note the, and this is for an annual basis, this was not a year in which they were renewing. If they're renewing, we'd be taking an additional revenue. You have to understand that these are biannual renewals. So one year, for instance, I think the barbers and hairdresser year was a renewal year. They take in a considerable amount of money, so they may have a little excess over their expenditures. But in the next year, all we're going to take in is any new licensees or any things of that nature, so that they end up balancing each other off.
Are these fees set by regulation?
Yes, they are.
I remember last year we went through this whole list of all the professions
right.
and all the fees for them.
And if I might point out, currently we're taking in revenues in excess of the amount of money that we're able to collect. So I would not like to be in the business of raising their fees more, because currently we're not able to collect all the fees that we are currently charging them. And that's the one, in fact, for the Finance Committee, we have a budget request in to capture the additional amount of the fees that we are collecting from these various boards.
You mean you don't have budget authority to
That's
collect
right.
all the money that,
That's correct.
You have regulatory?
We set the over the last 2 years, many of the boards have increased their fees, and we went to a biannual renewal cycle. So that gave us additional money more quickly. It used to be quadrennial renewal cycle. But unfortunately, the legislature has never agreed to increase our appropriation, so that in fact now we are taking in additional funds, but we're not able to utilize those within the budget of the division.
Oh, so you're taking in money, you just can't utilize them within
the
budget.
That's correct. It's going into the general fund.
Oh, okay. The other issue here is that it seemed to us at that time that some of the professions were undercharged for their licenses, and some of the things that you wouldn't think would be that profitable were paying more.
$100 biannually, which is, doctors pay $400 biannually. Nurses pay $62.50 by annually, so it depends on where you are. But as I said, we probably could do some adjustments, but in point of fact, we are collecting more money than we are able to utilize within the division, and I'm somewhat reluctant to.
Well, yeah, but my concerns run as to who you're collecting it from. You know, there's some of those professions, I would say the doctors were one, that were running way underwater.
Yeah, but they're paying now $400.
Yeah, I'd be real interested in seeing an assessment of where they're at on that now, how much they're just getting off the other professions because they're paying their way more than they are paying theirs. And there were a few other professions like that, too, I remember from that analysis.
Right.
Well, what I ask you to do is, can you put something like a packet that we had last year that says what you've done different from last year in any of those
sure.
levels and
sure.
get it to the committee here for information?
Sure.
And we may want to take a look at that and make some suggestions to you about
okay.
straighten out some of those. Is there anybody else here to testify on House Bill 96? So, Chair would entertain a motion with individual recommendations.
I don't mean to hold the bill up, but I have received a lot of complaints about the board and the way it operates, and I don't. I kind of hate to see us automatically extending it without giving them some direction in terms of kind of cleaning up their act, because I have had a lot of complaints about the board's refusal to work with the public and apparently efforts to do some power grabbing and some money grabbing. I always have a problem when I see a board, particular board, trying to exclude people from performing a service and doing it to the convenience of the public. And I guess I'm not going to object to having it passed out of committee, but I have a real concern with this board. Some boards have a problem with
Representative Collins, if you want us to set up another time or something and look into that, I'm willing to hold the bill.
I would appreciate it if you would.
Okay. Well, then the chair would remove its request for such a motion, and we're just going to hold the bill over, and you can send a message to the veterinarians that there's some concerns about how they're running their shop, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, really hoping Representative Grunberg would be here today so we could address this House Bill 41. Is there anybody from Representative Miller's staff here? Okay. I guess not. Well, it's the chair's intent to get this bill out of here. I want to move this bill, but I'm having problems because the person who's raising the concerns about it hasn't seemed to be able to figure out what they want to do. This House Bill 41, licensing, is it farming? So I'm going to hold it over until Thursday, or let's hold it over to Thursday once we get it. And there may be the chance to bring it up again later today. If it comes up, I want to bring it up again. Yeah. So I'm just going to set it here for now. Okay, so at that time we're
This has two other kinds of referral. It goes to resources and it goes to finance. Would it be possible for Representative Bloomberg to perhaps put his suggestions or concerns in writing? And he's got to work ways to address it.
I know that Representative calls this. The fear I have is he's going to want to do it to be here if he doesn't have a chance to fix it. Let's hear what Andy says. Oh, yeah? Okay.
The ghost committee members.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to bring the bill up this time, then. Apparently, there's whatever objections that we're going to remove. Sure. And they're not. So we don't have a CS anymore for it. I think we all know what the bill does. Apparently, farmers were never under the business license requirements, and there was an interpretation of the existing statute that said they should be if you were the way the existing statute was. This bill would simply put it back the way it is now. They're not under there, but the new interpretation would find that they will be if we don't do something about this. Representative Miller, you want to join us? I'm just re-explaining your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone here from the public to testify in House Bill 41? Okay. What's the will of the committee on this bill? Representative Collins?
I move that we move House Bill 41 out of committee with the recommendations.
Okay. Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, bill moves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry about that, Representative Miller. Okay, so we're going to go on teleconference now. This is the House Labor and Commerce Committee in Juneau, and trying to connect with Anchorage. Is there somebody there, moderator there?
I'm dialing them right now.
No, we didn't do anything. Oh, I didn't know about that. Did the Solid Waste Subcommittee have a report on today?
Yeah,
okay. They were on the floor.
Right.
Yeah. Same with the electric. Okay, we're almost still on schedule. Dave Donnelly and Juneau, House Labor and Commerce Committee, President of Representative Spahnholz, Collins, Lehman, Boucher, and Boyer, myself. We're going to be starting testimony now on House Bill 166. Are there any members of the public here from out of town today that have gone to testify on House Bill 166?
Yes, I'm sure.
Okay. I want to go ahead and facilitate anybody who's from out of town and do that first. Did you want to come forward and give testimony? I'm going to, if it's not on the specific subject, I want to limit it to like 5 minutes and then move on to the subjects that we've got before us.
Okay.
If there's anybody else from out of town, if you could sign in, let me know. I want to get you in. So we're going to proceed with testimony. If you could just state your name for the record and who you represent.
I'm Bernard Kelly, attorney from Anchorage, Alaska. And
I'm here to testify on House Bill 166.
Please proceed.
Shall I proceed?
Yes.
I wanted to say that I'm here to contend that we don't need a solution as radical as House Bill 166. I know that there's a problem in availability and affordability of insurance, and it's a very serious problem. And in my mind, the solution that House Bill 166 affords would be a mistake. I just had a few things that I wanted to say. I had a suit against Hartford Insurance Company last year, and they are alleged to be one of the two principal conspirators that started this whole mess about 4 years ago. What happened is, and I've given copies of the Hartford Current paper that came out while I was there in this suit against Hartford, and the allegations contained in the Hartford Current specify what the insurance companies, notably Allstate and Hartford, did that started this problem relative to the taking away the reinsurance. Allegations in there are very well stated, and they form part of the Attorney General suit of our state against certain areas of the insurance industry. What happened was that Allstate and Hartford are alleged to have conspired with other companies, notably Cigna and Aetna and some others mentioned in that article, to have gone to general reinsurance companies, the Lloyd's reinsurance interests, and other reinsurers, national reinsurance group, and got them to basically pull the plug out from under the insurance market. This today is still a major problem in our getting insurance, and it's a major problem in cost. And our state is starting to do something, hopefully, about that. Later in the session, J. Robert Hunter is going to, I understand, be available to testify as a witness, and he researched this problem for me. What was being stated by Hartford and Allstate and some of the other companies is that, yes, it was partly our fault that we have an insurance crisis, our fault meaning Allstate and Hartford, but that we shot ourselves in the foot, we undersold our product during a period of time, and now we have a capacity crunch. Capacity is a term in the insurance industry that relates to something they call earned surplus. And earned surplus can be understood to be very, very similar to, if not the same for our purposes, is net worth. But the idea being that the insurance companies shouldn't prudently ever try to sell more insurance in terms of premium dollars collected from customers that they sell insurance to, then maybe three or four times their net worth. Otherwise, they're getting themselves into problems, because if they have catastrophic losses, it may go way beyond their ability to pay for it. So that's a kind of a rule of thumb in the industry. Conservative underwriting practices call for selling at about 2.5 times your net worth. And the thing is, what we found about Hartford is their representations were all false. When Hunter checked this out, and this is documentable stuff, they have something like, and they did have over a period of several years leading up to the time that they began this agitation for tort reform, they had something like a net worth of $1 billion a year, roughly. What they were doing is selling insurance to approximately the same amount in terms of premium dollars. So they had a 1-to-1 ratio on their net worth, and their representations that they had a capacity crunch is just plain out and out fraud and a lie. So, you know, to me, this needs to be investigated. I believe that this thing can be corrected. It could be corrected by the industry itself if they're brought to tow, and that's the purpose of this kind of a suit. And I, you know, for me, I see the taking away of innocent victims' rights is not the best way to go. I think that the answer here lies in looking at a solution other than that, where you've got an industry that is playing fast and loose in an effort to try to take away rights. Now, somebody around here within the legislative group is trying to point out to California, for example, as an idea where maybe the doctor solved their problem in California by going to tort reform. I don't think it shows that at all. I think we can demonstrate that, but the data needs to be brought to bear. What I think it shows is that if people go out and insure themselves by getting their own doctor's insurance company or their own, or becoming in some way their own insurer, that there's so much fat in this insurance pie that if it's truly and properly priced, that we'll save money. Robin Taylor likes to tell the story of how the ALPAC got started. That was a group that was basically formed by the Southeast loggers, and they made so darn much money with their own loggers insurance company. ALPAC eventually was taken over by INA. I just think that is a better way to look, and I want to ensure this group that we will try to make available all the data we can to make sure that you receive the best information possible. One of the things that bothers me so much, we have in this bill a statute of repose that would bar claims 6 years after an event like a manufactured aircraft. And I was involved in that Wien case back in 19, where a wing came off a plane at Eliana in 1968, killed all 39 people aboard. This bill would take away everybody's rights in that case against the manufacturer, and they were found to be incredibly at fault in this thing. They had promised the FAA they would help the operators do inspections. They had been told by the designer of the aircraft, Fokker of Holland, that they should redesign their design problems in the aircraft that were commensurate with what Fokker had done in the European market. They didn't do it. They didn't keep their promises. I represented the four crew members' families in that case, and we could not have recovered against Wien Airlines because our people were under the workers' compensation for the airline. The only way we recovered was proving Churchill at fault. Those cases would have all gone by the boards if we had the six-year statute of repose. It would have been barred before the accident even happened, and I just think that's a terrible mistake. And here we have a bunch of Alaskan people victimized by an outside manufacturer. It's like this bill might be, more enthusiastically received in a state like California where they have McDonnell Douglas, but I sure don't understand it being promoted by Alaskans, where it can only, in some cases like that, impact upon our local citizens. So I just want you to know that I'm, standing by available to act as a supplier of information. We're going to try to have Mr. Hunter here at a point in time, and he certainly is a great expert. He was the National Insurance Administrator under both Ford and Carter, so he's a bipartisan guy. And Bob is one of only 100 people in the world that's a member of the International Academy of Actuarial Sciences, so he's a renowned expert. And I think I know 3 years ago he figured we were paying way too much for our insurance dollar up here by looking over the annual insurance report. Compared to the rest of the country, we're being taken. And insurance companies surely can't. They've got to like Alaska a lot from what I can see. So, I just want to thank you for hearing me here and stand available for whatever I can do.
Okay, there may be questions. Any questions?
Thank you. I'm real ignorant on this whole subject, and I'm curious. The other day, in our general overview, we heard some suggestion that you could discriminate in your statute of repose. Discriminate to provide a statute of repose for in-state products or, individuals like engineers and that type of thing, products or services. and that it didn't make sense, as you just suggested, to provide some kind of a statute for outside manufacturers. I think the reference the other day was with regard to pharmaceuticals, or same kind of thing. In your experience, can we discriminate that way?
I think that's going to be awfully hard to do. Most of the things that are manufactured are going to come from outside anyway, because we're basically a state whose main thing to sell in the marketplace are natural resources. They're not going to be manufacturing too much of anything here. I think that it's hard because you've got the equal protection of laws and you can't just make exceptions here and there to sue Alaska, but I just think the whole concept is a mistake.
Mr. Chairman, is there any state that discriminates in their statutes or proposed for then services by professional engineers or whoever else might
be in this kind of statute? Well, we've been aware that for a long time they've had a statute that would seem to favor and make a six-year statute for engineers and architects. I think that thing fails again for discrimination and singling out one group. I can tell you that the professional liability is terrible for lawyers and everybody else, and to some extent, it sounds like the doctors are being singled out, maybe for preferential treatment. I'm not saying they're not entitled to be protected fairly, but I think there's a question and a problem anytime you start saying, well, this group gets favored and that group doesn't. And I just see that as an equal protection potential problem.
Thank you. Mr. Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the House Judiciary Committee last Monday, Richard Monkman testified. Mr. Monkman's an assistant attorney general, and he's representing the state of Alaska in the multi-state antitrust lawsuit against the insurance company, the one that's brought by New York, California, and a bunch of other states. He informed us that there's a difference between that case that's going forward in the federal court for the Northern District of California on the one hand, and the case that's being brought in Texas Superior Court by the state of Texas on the other. Those are the two major antitrust lawsuits against the insurance industry, the one by the state of Texas in the state law, in the state courts, and the other by various states in the federal district court in San Francisco. And one of the differences he cited between the two cases was that in the Texas lawsuit, one of the allegations that's not found in the federal case was that allegedly the insurance companies had manufactured the tort crisis by selecting certain groups, certain professions, namely, and including but not limited to, the medical profession, to raise their rates, thereby creating crisis, and thereby taking an articulate group who would speak out in favor of tort reform and using them as the point people to start this tort reform movement. That is an allegation in the Texas lawsuit that's not found in the federal lawsuit that the state of Alaska has joined. I didn't ask him, why don't you add a count in the federal lawsuit alleging the same thing that Texas is doing? So I don't know what his answer would have been to that question. I'm going to ask you.
I'm going to tell you that in the Texas lawsuit, one of their key witnesses is J. Robert Hunter. I'll bet you it has a lot to do with Mr. Hunter's insights. And I think you could ask him, and you'd probably get a very good answer, but I know he's involved in that Texas suit. He's a witness in that suit.
Is he involved in the federal case?
I don't think so.
Have you seen any evidence that would lead you to believe that there would be evidence to support such a claim, that the insurance companies have conspired to create the tort crisis?
Thank you. Definitely. But I'm not sure that I can make it as selectively as what you're saying.
Well, just generally, what have you found?
Well, for example, in this Hartford thing, I don't know if you have in front of you, but one of the best statements I've ever seen in a succinct way of exactly how it's contended that the insurers conspired to take away the reinsurance market is found in this Hartford Current article. And I don't know, I'm not sure if this is yet. I think Representative Lehman's got one there. It was my intent, and I will put more of these in front of you. I think this pretty well describes how they went about this in chapter and verse. They're stating that on such and such a date and such a place, they're meeting in a hotel room or meeting in Hartford or something like that. Those allegations seem to me so pinpointed that they must have an exact factual fix on exactly what happened.
I understand. And this, the allegation here that they're discussing is that they conspired to restrict coverage. It seems to me that the gravamen of what Mr. Monkman said to us was that they went one step further. And not only did they restrict coverage, but they also had the intent of creating a crisis that would lead to a reform of the tort law system in this country. That was their intent. Their intent was to utilize this not only to jack up the prices, but also to change the law by putting pressure on various groups so that the tort system would be changed to make it more favorable to defendants and thereby reduce the claim.
I agree with you. I think what happened, I can kind of almost feel it because...
I think we're going to be spending a couple meetings on this subject.
I'm sorry.
And I really want to get on with the statute of repose and some of the other more specifics. And Mr. Kelly, you did address that earlier, and if you could stand by, I don't have anybody else here in Juneau signed up to testify, but we do have people in Anchorage.
Thank you.
To
testify. I apologize.
Sure. Representative Lehman, did you have a question that dealt with the area we're trying to focus in on today?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kelly, this past week, I just read an article from a national newsletter that said that the state of Mississippi has revised its statute of repose from 6 years to 3 years. And I haven't seen the specifics of the bill, but it caught my attention because we're dealing with it here and wondered if you were aware of that. And if so, if you have any comments about it.
Well, I think that's, welcome to the 19th century, is all I can say. I mean, you could have... If we had no liability for anyone for anything, then why do we need insurance? I mean, that's kind of the focus of something that becomes out restrictive. I just think that hopefully we believe in some degree of justice, and if your children are crippled and injured for life due to somebody's carelessness, they should have some responsibility for that. And I think this three-year thing that bars you before you even know you have a claim is just wrong. Look at it this way. If we have an outside contractor building a big public building in Juneau or Anchorage, and the thing collapses because they didn't build it according to specification, and it's like a school building, and your kids end up badly crippled, and you have to pay medical bills for the rest of your life, and they come to you and say, sorry, you're out of luck, that building was built 4 years ago. You can see how terrible I think that would be. Hope you agree. I just think that that's not responsible. If they're negligently failing to do that which they promised to do, and an accident of that kind happens, there should be responsibility for it. And that really is why I think these statutes of repose are so wrong. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity to ask a question here. Mr. Kelly, the whole business about statutes of repose is one that I'm learning about. I expect you spent a lot of time with it, but you probably know that most other states have some statutes of repose. Isn't that true?
Not that I know of. Statutes of repose bar you before a negligent act even occurs that causes a harm. And I just think that our concept, I understand it in this country, has been that wait until an accident happens and somebody's on notice that they've got a basis for a claim before they start taking away rights. To me, that I would hope that, and I don't know if states that have that kind of restriction, but I question the constitutionality of it, but even more I question the fairness of it.
Mr. Chairman, this also applies to the Committee for its information. A list of somewhere between 30 and 40 states that do have statutes of repose that have been upheld by those state courts. And you're probably aware that our state did disallow the statute of repose recently in the case of Turner. And for your thing, I'll pass this on to you, too. Some states, in fact, and the other question I want to ask, Mr. Chairman, had to do with who can you exclude? To me, it doesn't make that much difference about, we certainly don't have any product liability concerns here in Alaska, as you point out, not much manufacturing here. I was thinking more of a construction medical malpractice. It appears that some states have specific statutes for malpractice and for construction. So I'd be interested in getting your comments on what might most be appropriate for Alaska. They seem to be either 4 years, 6 years, or 10 years. There's a few other odd ones in here, seven, a three-year medical malpractice in Tennessee. Any event, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll just stop there and say that I'll make that information available to the committee and to Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Yeah, for the committee's information, we have two pieces of information in your packets. We have this article about statutes of repose, and then we also have this breakout on statutes of repose. All right. The only thing is that I think we're also going to want to take a look at the scope of these statutes. Some of them rule constitutional, some of them rule unconstitutional. I think I'm going to request the staff try to get from House Research additional information so we know what the parameters of these were, in addition to just if they were 6 years, 7 years, or whatever. I see some of these in this one article specify certain things.
Mr. Chairman, I'll give you right now a list that describes each state's statute. Got it right here, so I'll turn that to you.
Okay, great.
And I would hope that information would also indicate whether or not they've been tested in the court system in any of the states.
This has pending cases. A lot of these are undecided yet, pending cases, and these mentioned when they were upheld or when they were overturned. Okay. Okay, good. I'd like to go to Anchorage now, called Dr. McGuire. Dr. McGuire, are you there in Anchorage?
He's approaching the mic.
I am.
Okay. After Dr. McGuire, I'm going to call Dean Rogusta. Dr. McGuire, today we're trying to focus in on statute of repose and the other matters on the agenda. If you wish to address the committee on those, please proceed.
I do. Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, go ahead with your testimony. Hi, my name is David McGuire. I'm an orthopedic surgeon in Anchorage. I'm happy to testify on the bill before us, and specifically on those portions regarding the statute of limitations, and I came prepared to discuss wrongful death, capital and non-economic damages and collateral source if you would like to do that. The basic underlying reason for the statute of limitations, well expressed in the Code of Civil Procedure 0910-070, and if I may, I'd like to read from that. The purpose of a statute of limitations, the goal of the statute of limitations and the substituted service procedure, is to provide speedy adjudication of claims. The next paragraph. The purposes of statutes of limitations is to encourage promptness in the prosecution of actions and thus avoid the injustice which may result from the prosecution of stale claims. Paragraph. Statutes of limitations attempt to protect against the difficulties caused by lost evidence, fake memories, and disappearing witnesses. This section reflects a state policy that a plaintiff's commencement of action is the affirmative step necessary to assure that his assertion of a claim is timely. Now, the problem, you see, is that we are balancing the rights of the individual against the rights of the society as a whole. And if we had a system that was working, none of us would be here today. But the system isn't working, and you've been hearing testimony from multiple sources that it isn't working. What we argue about are the causes of why it isn't working. Everyone by now, I think, may be familiar with the policy called Claims Made Insurance. But for those of you that might not be familiar with it, I'd like to introduce the concept to you. Because if it were enforced by the mafia, we would make a law against such a policy. But since there is no other way, apparently, for the insurance companies to do business, we are all subjected to this animal called Claims Made Insurance. And the reason we have Claims Made Insurance is because we have lost the ability to predict how long a liability action may be brought against any individual or insurance company. Here's how it goes. Claims made, we used to have a thing called occurrence insurance. That meant that if you bought a policy from a company, and if something happened during the term of that policy, we're covered. The problem is that sometimes these actions were occurring some 40 years after the fact. The insurance company, clever animals that they are, said, hey, we can't stand that. We've got to have a new policy, and so we'll have claims made. Here's how it works. You must be insured when the event occurs, and you must further be insured with the same company when the claim is made. The provision is that you may buy a tail claim coverage if you want to leave the company. Now, I'm going to give you the example of Cordova, which you may have heard last from Dr. Art Pilsner, but to show you that this is real life and not an imaginary possibility, here's how it worked in Cordova. I think by now you're all familiar with MICA, and I would suspect that most of you understand that MICA is not a for-profit corporation and isn't greedy as so many others are said to be. The doctors in Cordova bought insurance from MICA in 1977. They continued buying insurance at ever-escalating rates until in 1985, when their insurance for the three of them went to $64,000. They said, with our small practice in Cordova, we can't afford $64,000. Whereupon their choices were drop their coverage or buy a tail policy. Now, the price of the tail policy was $104,000. And you can well imagine that if they didn't have $64,000, they surely didn't have $104,000. And the net effect is they had to quit buying insurance. And the net effect of that, because of claims made, is that the insurance company was able to keep the money, and they no longer have any obligation to any of the patients or to the doctors in Cordova from 1977 through 1985, even though the payments were made every year. Now, are we going to say that MICA is the guilty party in this instance, that MICA is guilty of some sort of greedy, avaricious attitude? I don't think so. I think what we have to say is that we used to have meaningful statutes of limitations that said you will be held liable for X number of years for your activity, and after that number of years, you will not be liable. And therefore, the insurance company could predict how long they had to cover the policy, and therefore, we had occurrence insurance. Now, if I may, let me give you another example that is the ultimate catch-22, it seems to me. Clearly, I speak more of medicine because I'm most familiar with it, but I think it applies equally well to other situations. We have the instance now that a minor is allowed to sue for an action that occurred to him or her after reaching the age of majority. Yet, paradoxically, if a surgeon or a physician is to take care of the minor while yet a minor, he or she must obtain the consent of the guardian or parent. So watch how it works. You get the consent from the guardian or the parent, and you treat the minor, and the minor waits until they reach the age of majority and say, well, I'm sorry, I don't like the result, and notwithstanding the fact that my legal guardian gave consent, I'm still going to sue you anyway. And if you think I'm making up stories, that case happened in Nome, and I'd be happy to provide you more evidence with it later. Now, the end result is that we have no meaningful statutes of limitations in many, many places. And yet, in other places, we have statutes of limitations. And that such should be the case seems to me to be unusual. If I may, again, from the Code of Civil Procedure, misrepresentation and negligence are tort concepts, not contract, and the two-year statute of limitation respecting torts governs, period. It doesn't say anything about any exception to that in that paragraph. But we go to the next one, and then we have an exception and an exception and an exception. Now then, we've heard testimony earlier that we shouldn't have special interest legislation. The gentleman speaking before me said that the doctors were getting or wanted special treatment, and that the reason the architect's statute of repose was thrown out was because they were held to have special interest protection. So in the bill that's before you, I see no evidence of special interest protection. It says purely and simply, you've got 2 years to sue for a problem that occurs when you reasonably discover it, and if you reasonably discover it and don't sue at the end of those 2 years, you're not allowed to sue, and that overall, you have 6 years to do it. Now, let us all admit that this is an arbitrary period of time. You could make it 1 year, or you could make it 2, or you could make it 3, or you could make it 100. But the fact of the matter is, it won't work at 100. It will work at 6. And for those of you with votes, you have to decide, I guess, whether to the extent that those can be specifically defined, let's make some reasonable exceptions. But I remind you, the reason we are here today is because the system isn't working. So take the example of a foreign body, not for a therapeutic purpose. Everybody says, well, doctor, you want to get away with leaving a sponge in some poor person's abdomen, and 10 years later they've been sick. They finally find it, and they shouldn't be able to sue you. Well, so make an exception. But make those exceptions now, make them clearly defined, and make them applicable, and don't have it so that anybody can sue any time from now till kingdom come, or else we are going to continue to have claims made insurance, at an ever-escalating price that no one can afford any longer. Thank you on that. If there are questions, I'd be happy to talk about the other items if you'd like.
Representative Grimberg?
Yes, Dr. McGuire, you had talked about if you're going to have exceptions, make them narrow. Specifically, what kind of exceptions do you recommend and how should we draft them?
Well, I think that there ought not to be very many.
Give me some examples.
As soon as you begin to make one exception, everybody has another exception that they think ought to be there. The one that I think I have absolutely no problem with whatever is the concept that if, specifically with medical malpractice of the foreign body not intended for a therapeutic purpose, I have no problem whatever with removing the statute of limitations when there is evidence of fraudulent concealment of information that would otherwise have allowed the individual to ascertain that they had an injury. So those are two concrete exceptions that can be made. Now, as we go along the line, I'm sure that there are other people that are going to pose an exception. But to say, for example, that an individual 6 years later ought to be able to sue the architect for designing a fireplace when the fireplace had apparently worked well for 6 years, I think stretching the point a bit. Then we end in the position in which none of us can predict what the end of our liability is, and we're back to claims made. You know, even the IRS has a statute of limitations.
Doctor, you've given us two exceptions to the normal rule that you would support, at least for medical malpractice, and I assume there are analogies that could be done in these other areas as well. Number one was a foreign body not intended for therapeutic purpose. Another was in the case of fraudulent concealment. How about in the case of negligent concealment?
I guess you'd have to define negligent concealment for me. I don't understand what that is.
Well, you adopt the theory of negligence to concealment.
Mr. Chair? Could I jump in on that?
Attorneys, what does negligent concealment mean? That they should have found out there was something wrong and neglected to tell you?
That's right.
Well, I don't know. That seems to me to be a very interesting thought process.
There's a case on the subject by the
name of... you sue them for being negligent, but if they didn't know they caused you the harm, I don't quite follow that rationale.
There's a case you might look at.
If you do that, then every time something happens that's beyond the statute of limitations, the immediate allegation will be that there was negligent concealment of information, and therefore the statute should be told, and therefore we ought to have another lawsuit to settle the problem. And I would suggest to you that most of us in this country aren't benefiting from the proliferation of these lawsuits.
Representative Cox.
Yeah, just if I could jump in on this particular case here, I'm looking at the Tennessee statute of repose and limitations on dealing specifically with malpractice, and I make sure you have a copy of this too, but one section says that there's an exception for fraudulent concealment on the part of the defendant, on the part of the defendant which the case of action shall be commenced within 1 year after discovery. And then the next one is, time limitations herein set forth shall not apply in cases where a foreign object has been negligently left in a patient's body, in which case the action shall be commenced again within 1 year. So in both cases that Mr. Grunberg has pointed out, the Tennessee malpractice statute of repose covered those two points, and I don't think that that's an unreasonable exception from what I know about it now.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Doctor, I know you've done a lot of reading in the area. There's a case on the subject in this state you might take a look at, the name of Howarth versus Pfeiffer.
Okay. Dr. McGuire, you want to go ahead with the other subjects? We really got to keep rolling here.
I'm talking as fast as I can. There's been a lot of discussion about the wrongful death, and may I suggest that the language as presented in the bill before you was not the language that was intended. And without much ado about what this was supposed to be, let me put forth what I consider to be a very simple concept, and I don't claim originality for the concept. If an individual has no legal heirs or dependents, then it does not serve our society well to have huge sums of money awarded to distant relatives, to estates that go to the state or to other kinds of entities. Far better it is that if an individual has no legal dependents, there is no one to whom this individual looks for support in the legal sense, then there should be a cap on the award for the wrongful death, fundamentally, no matter what the context.
Now, there is precedent in our own state of Alaska. The workman's statutes, the workman's comp statutes, in the event of no survivors, no legal dependents, however we'd like to say that, but nobody to which the decedent owed a duty of support, we pay $10,000. And interestingly, that $10,000 goes into the second injury fund. And even more interesting than that, that sum is now at $5 million, and the interest on that sum goes to the general fund of the state of Alaska. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that there is precedent in the state law of Alaska, namely the workman's comp statutes that have been passed. Next, it is something that is in the general interest of society. Next, that to award an individual with no dependents does no good whatever for our society. Thank you. To proceed on the others, if there are questions on this, I'm happy to answer those.
Okay, I don't see any questions. You want to go ahead?
There's been a great deal of discussion about caps on non-economic damages. And I'd like to be certain that we have no misconceptions or misrepresentations about what this is or is not. First of all, there's been an allegation that putting a cap on non-economic damages would be discriminatory to children, women, subsistence hunters, and others who do not have a W-2 form at the end of the year. I suggest that that's hogwash. We define value for a homemaker by whatever it takes to replace the services the homemaker provided. The same can be said for any of the other categories. And if there be any doubt about that concept, then let us write it in the legislation that specifically spells out that each individual has some verifiable economic worth. Now, I hope, having dispensed with that false notion, that we can then begin to discuss what is really meant by a non-economic injury. A non-economic injury is pain and suffering, loss of consortium, humiliation, public embarrassment, or whatever other sort of thing that we can't attach a value to but we think is pretty bad. Now, may I remind you that if we had a system that was working, we wouldn't all be here today. So, it is the art of the compromise. It is saying that we are going to decide, as a society, that what we can apparently afford is an unlimited sum to reward or to compensate individuals for pain and suffering. And we're going to say that no individual's pain and suffering is any more valuable than any other individual's pain and suffering. And we're going to say that if your claim, having been totally satisfied for the economic losses, is that you are claiming pain and suffering, then no matter how horrible, how bad, how awful, we're going to put a cap on it. Because I remind you, the system isn't working, number one. Number two, we as physicians see thousands of examples of pain and suffering every day that go uncompensated. So it's not morally incorrect to say that we're going to put a limit. Now, in the 1986 legislation, there was a negotiated settlement between a former attorney general and those of us who were there that there would be an exception to severe disfigurement. This was meant as a compromise in good faith, but when the legislation came out, it included severe physical impairment. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when you include the two of those, you create an exception so large as to swallow the rule, if you will. In other words, this is a cap that is no cap. Because any time there's pain and suffering that is alleged to be more than $500,000, surely there will be some kind of severe injury. So you see, we don't have a cap, even though those that don't want caps argue that this is a cap. It's not. And once again, it's a matter that we've got to make the system work. Better it is to have many compensated than a few very well. I'd like to remind you that approximately 70% the obstetricians delivering babies in the city of Anchorage are now uninsured. Now, I think that everyone will be hard-pressed to make the claim that we are serving well those children born today who have every right under this system protected till the cows come home. They haven't any place to get the money that they win with all the rights that we've protected. So you see, we're busy creating victims every day by our inaction to this system that's out of control. The issue of collateral source is once again, in my opinion at least, that of a societal resource. We say that an individual went out and bought health insurance. Yes, they bought health insurance, but what did they really buy? They bought participation in a pool of individuals in which it was hoped and held that fewer would be sick than remain well. Because if all were sick, then it would, by definition, be prepaid medical insurance. And if that were the case, at the price health insurance is, I doubt if anyone could afford it. So you see, it isn't just the individual that we're thinking about. It's the society as a whole. Now, consider the case that when an individual, by virtue of health insurance or state benefits or any other collateral source payment, has their economic loss returned to them. The bills are paid. Why are we paying them again for the same bill? We're consuming the resource of society, and it is double-dipping. Now, if you want to argue that the individual, from his own resources, paid into this pool, and that as a result of that, he or she should be compensated for the money paid into the pool, I have no objection whatever. It makes sense. But to argue that they should get that compensation plus a double compensation for their hospital bill or whatever simply makes no sense whatever. The next point. The jury doesn't get to know that in many instances, all of the medical bills, the rehabilitation services, the prosthetic devices, etc., have already been paid for by another policy. And the jury is led to believe that there is a poor, destitute individual in front of them with absolutely no resource whatever. Well, quite naturally, humane as I'd like to hope we all are, we would attempt to make it a award, and we do. So, it's our contention. There should be an offset, and the jury ought to get to know the whole truth, nothing but the truth, etc. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take Sherry Gall next here in Juneau, and then we're going to move on to Mr. Roguska. If you could step forward, and I'll call on you soon, Sherry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sherry Gall. I represent the Alaska Women's Lobby, and I'd like to express our concerns today about the sections of the bill that are on your calendar. And I'll begin with Section 2, the Statute of Repose. And I certainly don't purport to be an expert on various states and their statutes of repose, but my understanding was that many of the states have a statute of repose, and it deals mostly with construction and buildings. And this handout that I just recently received here today seems to imply that's true. I see five states that don't refer to completion of buildings. Of the three sections of subsections of that section, I guess I have the least concern over the problem of buildings and the most concern over the way that the statute of repose would affect personal injury, medical malpractice, and the manufacture of unsafe products. I guess I'd like to remind you all about the Dalcon Shield, and the fact is that many of those people were, the Dalcon Shield caused irreversible harm in many people, and this was not known to the victims for sometimes 10 years after they used this unsafe product. It resulted in the inability to bear children for many people, and I think that there should be no reason for them to be denied compensation, as they would be should that case happen under this proposed bill before you. Another incident like that is the drug DES, which is a drug that was prescribed to women in the early 50s to protect them from miscarriages, and certainly it was not known to them until their daughters were in their 20s and 30s that those female children born to those women who took this drug were quite apt to and did develop cancers. And the correlation between the use of that drug and the effects many years later on a victim, not even the person having taken the drug, but the person was in utero at that time. This is another instance of things that affect women, because women's medicine is somewhat experimental in nature. They often have new procedures and new medications that they put out to the public before a considerable amount of time. Sometimes it does take 10 to 20 years to discover which kinds of drugs and devices will cause cancer at a much later time. So it seems that having a statute of repose that says 6 years is the limit, you must know in 6 years what your injury is, seems a little bit strict. And then regarding other products, it seems that every day we read in the newspaper about airplanes that are falling apart in the sky. And the older the airplane, the more likely it is that the risk is there. So it would seem that one wouldn't want to restrict the rights of people who have to fly in airplanes to protect the rights of the manufacturers of those airplanes, that something must happen within 6 years of the manufacture. I think that probably not very many people buy Pintos anymore, but, you know, perhaps there's some other product that we just haven't yet discovered. You know, what's going to go wrong with it? What kind of a defect will cause injuries to people? And until that happens, I wouldn't like to see this statute of repose, which seems very restrictive to me, take place. The next section I'd like to talk about is Section 4 that deals with the 2-year limit for minors and incompetents. I think that in current law, you have 2 years from the time that you are able to take an action. In other words, if you're a minor, 2 years after you reach your majority, or if you are an incompetent, at some time when you acquire competency again and then could take a complaint, regain your competency. I think that it seems that the current statute is much fairer than to remove the exemption for minors and incompetents from the 2-year limit. Regarding collateral benefits, it seems to me that if a person has bought health insurance on their own and is covered either through their employer or just personally, that when they're injured and they make a claim against their health insurance to help to pay for the results of their injury, if at some later time there's a trial and they decide that somebody other than the person with the insurance is liable for that injury, then it would seem that the person who is liable should make up the difference to that person's insurance company. Just because they had insurance doesn't make the liability of the person who caused the injury less. Section 15 is the section that deals with wrongful death and the capping of the amount to $50,000. And I guess it's my testimony that Dr. McGuire was referring to, and I guess I still maintain that this cap for wrongful death is discriminatory, and it does discriminate against people who are non-wage earners, people with subsistence lifestyles, senior citizens, children, and homemakers. And I, especially if it's wrongful death, you know, I think that, and other times we were talking about non-economic damages, and the person wouldn't necessarily be dead, but now we're talking about the value of a life, you know, and somehow, if someone's life can be valued more because they had a higher paying job, it seems discriminatory to me. I guess those are the sections that you had on your calendar that I wanted to address. I would say that in Section 21, where it discusses the report would show to what extent the legal system has or has not been the cause of the liability, unavailability, and the increases in the rates. And it seems to me that several years ago, the first time I testified on a tort reform bill, I read in the newspaper a study that was done by a company called Jury Verdicts, Inc. And I wouldn't refer to those statistics because they seem like they might be out of date at this time. And I don't know whether that company is still in business, whether they still have done studies, but this was a study done in Alaska, and what that study showed was that indeed the cost, the amount of the verdicts was higher, but that those verdicts were rising with the cost of the health care, and that they weren't rising out of proportion to the costs involved. And that in fact, they gave a number, the number of jury verdicts that were, you know, large jury verdicts, $1 million, and they were very small, very few in number. And I would think that it might be beneficial to conduct this study that's called for in the report to see whether, if you complete a study like this, what it will show, you know, before you pass legislation, where on the first page, the purpose section implies that by restricting the rights of the injured person, it will result in increasing the availability and the affordability of insurance.
Thank you, ma'am. We're going to try to keep rolling here, guys, because we've got eight more people testify from Anchorage, and now we just extended our teleconference time to which we can represent Collins.
I just have a brief question. I want to make sure I heard Ms. Gall correctly. And with regard to collateral benefits, did I hear you say that you thought it would be appropriate to have the party at fault compensate the insurance company for medical costs?
Well, I believe that the cost of I believe that if an insurance company has had to pay for the results of that injury, that why should that insurance company, for whom the injured person has paid a premium and they have their own separate thing, why should that insurance company incur the liability if the injured person was not liable, if it was the result?
So you would have that payment made to the insurance company as opposed to the injured person.
Well, that seems like a sensible thing to do. But I think what we're talking about here is whether or not the jury should have the information on whether or not that person had insurance coverage. I think at this time, the judge considers the person's insurance coverage when the judge decides again whether the verdict was excessive. But I think it's a little bit like bringing in prior crimes into a crime into the courtroom for the jury to hear about other crimes separate from I just don't see why it's necessary to inform the jury whether or not the person has insurance before they decide what the proper amount of compensation is. And then I think the judge can consider whether or not there is excessive compensation going on here and reduce the verdict by that.
Okay.
But I guess it doesn't make sense if you're going to reduce the verdict by that amount if the money's going to go to the insurance company. I guess I just don't follow your logic.
Sure, I'm not going to talk about that. But thanks for your testimony today, Rips. Eamon, did you really, really have? I mean, we're going to have another opportunity, I'm sure. You'll be back here. Okay, Mr. Rebeska in Anchorage. And after Mr. Rebeska, I'm going to be taking Mike Flanagan from Anchorage. Mr. Rebeska there in Anchorage?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Go ahead.
My name is Gene Rebeska. I am president of the Citizens Coalition for Tort Reform. More importantly, though, I have been in the management and administration field for a number of years, and I'm very much familiar with the problems of the architectural and engineering community. In background, I was the director of aviation in the period when we were a territory. I was director of aviation in mid-1950 to the early 60s. I was director of aviation shortly after we became a state. I then was in the employment of an engineering firm in Anchorage. My role was management. From 1974 until just recently, I was the business manager for an architectural firm. I submit that I have some experience and can speak with some authority on the issue of statutes of limitation and repose. I have before me a couple of articles that I think would be of extreme importance in laying to rest the question of availability of information. First of all, I'm looking at a publication by the Office of Professional Liability Research of Victor O. Schinner and Company. This is dated 1988. The article is headlined Guidelines for Improving Practice. It further is headlined Statutes of Limitation and Repose. The article starts off by saying, almost 30 years have passed since the enactment in 1961 of the first special statute of limitation for lawsuits against architects, engineers, and others who design and build construction projects. During this period, much interest has been focused on the legislative programs that led to the enactment of such statutes and their interpretation by the courts once enacted. My purpose here is to say there are brief, concise statements as to what exists. This particular pamphlet, which is a two-page pamphlet, recites the state-by-state status of statutes of limitation and repose. For example, it starts off, Alabama, 7-year statute enacted in 1975.
Yeah, Mr. Roguska, we've got that information available to us now. If you wanted to go on this more precise testimony, I'd sure appreciate it.
The point I'd like to make is that there were 34 states in that list whose statutes have been upheld. In addition to that, two states who previously had their statutes deemed unconstitutional have passed additional legislation. It appears to me that that is preponderance of evidence that the public policy states the need for statute limitation and statute repose. He goes on to say that the average of limitations is in the 2 to 3 year range. The second document that I have has to do with a production of the American Medical Association, who discuss statute of limitation, and they address it from three specific aspects. One, specific medical liability statute of limitation, which states have them. They say every state has a statute of limitations applicable to medical liability action. However, in some states, the statute is a general one. States establishing a specific statute of limitations for medical liability cases are as follows, and they list 45. Under Section B, maximum statute of limitations period, they identify 24 states which have some form of definite maximum time limitation. Under the issue of minors, they identify 24 states which have amended their statutes of limitations relative to minors. So I suspect that there is a preponderance of information to rely upon. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to attempt to answer them.
Okay, I don't see any questions here. Thanks for your testimony. Mike Flanagan?
Members of the committee, I'm Mike Flanagan, I'm an attorney specializing in personal injury litigation here in Anchorage, and have been involved in a number of statute of limitations and statute of repose cases, including the Atkins case, the Hanabeth case, which established the discovery rule, the Atkins case of the first incompetent case, and I was involved in the Stiles case in Alaska, which in an unreported case was the first decision striking the statute of repose in the Third Judicial District. I've done a lot of research in this area, and let me go through some of the history of the statute of limitations and repose statutes. First of all, the repose statute, it's generally accepted that this was a creation of the Associated General Contractors Association that pushed this legislation through most of the states to originally give protection to architects, contractors, and engineers. And the purpose of the legislation was initially to limit their liability to a certain period of time once a building or article of construction was completed. The addition of products limitations, those have all come much later in time. The original granddaddy is this particular statute, which was pushed through by AGA throughout the United States. The problem with it is that courts are very concerned about the fact that architects, engineers, or contractors might fail to put fireproofing in buildings, might fail to install sprinklers, might fail to put beams of adequate size, and the gymnasium falls down and kills people, or the hotel falls down during a minor shake and many people are injured. And these kinds of results have caused many courts throughout the country to strike these statutes down as unconstitutional on not only equal protection grounds, but on substantive due process, which is the legislation doesn't make any sense. And I'd like to point out to the committee that although most of the cases striking down statute of repose are on equal protection grounds, the case in Alaska, which last year struck down the Alaska statute of repose statute, did it on substantive due process grounds. That is, they found that legislation makes no sense. And if that is the correct reading of that case, which I believe it is, then any attempt to recreate the statute of repose is subject to the exact same kind of challenge. And that's because there is no societal interest in protecting people from their torts in creating construction projects which are fundamentally flawed and then result in people's death, and creating a statute of limitations, in a sense, a grant of immunity, that as long as the injuries do not occur within 6 years or 4 years or whatever time limit you want to come up with, they're safe. That doesn't make any societal sense or purpose. And the fact that it may be cheaper for people to build buildings or construct construction is not adequate grounds for giving people license to do great harm to the public. That's why these statutes are fundamentally flawed, and that's why they shouldn't be allowed. Now, in regards to architects, engineers, and contractors, I'm not aware of any particular studies showing that these people are all going out of business because of inadequate insurance. In fact, I think insurance for these kinds of constructions are still widely available. There's a number of carriers in Alaska that sell this type of insurance, all different sizes. And these are costs that, if uniformly felt throughout the marketplace, can be passed through to society in the form of whatever fees or costs or expenses will have to be borne. And there is a way to reduce these costs, and that's not to construct buildings that have fundamental defects in them that cause severe injury or harm to people. Most of the large claims throughout the country that are reported are claims that involve fundamental flaws. I'm thinking about the Hyatt building where the bridge fell down, and no one can explain why they didn't even meet standard specs for the construction of it. There's a gymnasium that fell down in rural Alaska, and the beams apparently aren't the size they're supposed to be. I mean, these are things that there's no excuse for. Why should people who construct these buildings avoid liability for their actions simply because the tragedy that they allowed to occur simply didn't occur within 6 years? Now, there is insurance available that will cover specific building projects. People can go out and buy this insurance, and society should not have to bear the tremendous cost of inadequate construction of buildings. And as I pointed out, there's an easy way to protect yourself. You do what you're supposed to do. You don't build inadequate buildings that fall down and hurt people. Most of the claims, in my experience, in regards to construction, they involve fundamental flaws in buildings that are essentially undefensible. There aren't many claims brought against buildings for the paint not sticking to the building or the windows don't look right. I mean, normally, there's a huge fire or the building collapses or there's a great tragedy. So there's no reason to grant such a repose grant of immunity in regards to construction. Now, as to products manufactured, the same problem occurs. And as I think as one person has pointed out to the committee before, this is not a manufacturing state, so there's no particular reason for giving this largesse out to the manufacturers. This is a consumer state, and the problem for consumers when their statute reposes allowing manufacturers to escape liability after a limited period of years is that today, in today's technological era, products last decades. The airplanes that are flying today have been flying for 20 years, some of them, and can be expected to be flown for another 10 years. There are automobiles that are being driven 10 or 20 years. There's boats that are being driven for 30 or 40 years. And in many instances, and by the way, products liability case is one of the toughest cases to make. You can't normally succeed with one unless you can show a fundamental flaw in the manufacturer of the product, a defect. And we've had numerous examples of, most recently, the skin coming off the aircraft, doors blowing off the aircraft. There were some cases in California where life rafts that one would have hoped to never have to use were used by people whose boats were sinking. They pulled the life rafts out. They weren't equipped as they were to be equipped, and people starved to death. And there's automobile gas tank cases where the gas tanks explode 10 years or more afterwards. There's carburetor fires. There's the problem with the drugs, the thalidomide cases. The recent cases of the drugs for skin that were found to be causing defects in mothers. Many of these products will create problems many, many years after they're placed out into the market. And I'm not aware of manufacturers, the major manufacturers having any problem getting insurance. Most of them, in fact, my experience, most of them are at least partially self-insured. And it seems to me that there is no groundswell in this state, nor reason, to be giving manufacturers license to sell defective products in Alaska and avoid the consequences simply because they managed to not have have injuries from the products for a number of years. It also takes away the incentives to recall products or put out warnings to try to correct problems of products on the market if they know that they're scot-free after 6 or so years. So there isn't any valid basis for giving manufacturers such a grant of immunity. Now, the particular statute proposed goes further than just products and construction projects, and also tries to limit all claims to a certain period of time. What this does in a sidestep sort of way is tries to take away the rights of children and incompetents who can't bring suits on their own, can only bring them through adults. It's the law in the state. Children cannot bring claims on their own. And if they can't find somebody willing to do it, or if they don't have any parents or guardians, the wards of the state, they have no way of bringing the claim on their own. They can find no one to bring it, and their claims are going to go away because of their children. Now, that seems to me that society is not so threadbare that it has to take away the rights of children in order to have commerce succeed.
Okay, Mr. Flanagan, we've only got about another 13 minutes of teleconference time, if you could wrap it up for us.
All right. The same thing is true with incompetence, and incompetence are not only people who have trouble thinking. They can be people who are in a coma. They can be people who have suffered brain damage. They can be people just like you and me that suffer an accident and are just totally incapable of even talking about what happened to us for a number of years. And this does happen. And we shouldn't be taking the rights of those people away here simply because it's inconvenient to have them sue us later. Also, I point out that they're one of the big looming risks for society in the future is pollution. And all of these statutes proposed and statute of limitations would help people who may have been responsible for creating huge pollution expenses in the future, of avoiding these risks, the buried gas tanks that aren't adequately done, port facilities that are leaking. There's port facilities at Skagway, for instance, that are leaking lead. And we shouldn't be giving these people a grant of immunity simply because we haven't found the pollution or the effects of their pollution within a number of years. That's one of the huge expenses to society in the future, and we shouldn't be letting people off the hook now before we've even found all of the expenses and damages that we're going to have to pay later because of pollution. And I would yield this time to any questions.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. I'd like to take Mr. Franklin from Anchorage, and after Mr. Franklin, Mr. Snyder, Mike Snyder. And like I said, we're getting real short on time, so if you can keep your remarks brief.
Representative Donley, Mr. Franklin has left.
Okay, Mr. Snyder, are you there? And after Mr. Snyder, I'm going to take Mr. Klossman.
May it please the Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mike Snyder. I'm a practicing attorney in Anchorage, and I'll try to keep my remarks brief. They're going to be limited today to the proposed cap on non-pecuniary damages and wrongful death cases. I think that the first thing that I would hope that the committee would understand is that, let me just quote a part of the statute as it exists now. The amount recovered, if any, and let's see if that's the right part, when the decedent is survived by no spouse or children or other dependents, the amount recovered shall be administered as personal property of the decedent, here's the important part, but shall be limited to pecuniary loss. So, if the person that died is not a husband, is not a wife, is not someone's parent, or is not someone who the claimant can factually establish, that they are dependent upon, they're not going to get anything other than pecuniary loss to begin with. So let's make sure that we understand that we're not talking about giving away vast sums of money via jury verdicts to people who are not in fact and in law depended upon by the people making the claim. That just, the law doesn't work that way, never has in the state of Alaska, it doesn't in most other jurisdictions that I have any passing familiarity with. Secondly, while the notion was put before this committee earlier that, oh gosh, wouldn't it be nice and kind of egalitarian of us all simply to treat everyone's pain and grief, if you will, born out of a death equally, I suggest to the committee that indeed that's not what our system of justice is about. If you want systems of justice that treat everybody equally, there are a lot of them available. I'd refer the committee to Iran and some other places in the Middle East that have laws that apply with perfect equality across the board. Most of us think that, that is not the kind of system we want, and I hope this committee feels similarly. I think that we want the kind of system, and I submit to the committee that we have the kind of system, that addresses individual differences between parties. Juries in Alaska have never, and this committee has been shown, I submit, no case where a person, where the jury has given away the farm on non-pecuniary loss. I mean, where is the problem that we are attempting to address with this change in law? I submit that there is no problem. I submit that there are no cases that cannot be justified on the merits, and I submit that juries in Alaska have consistently been the voice of moderation in this area of damages. But should not a jury have a right to consider individual differences in a relationship that's lost? Should it, you know, if I love my wife dearly and she is killed by a wrongful act, should not my loss be greater than the guy who, you know, who is spared the burden of murdering his wife if so inclined? I mean, these are different kinds of relationships, and shouldn't a jury be given the opportunity to evaluate those very, very important facts that go to the guts of whether or not there is a loss and how big that loss is? Well, the suggestion has been is that the system doesn't work and the system's out of control. It's certainly, the evidence is that the system works very well for the insurance industry. This industry that's taken about $12.5 billion in tax-free money out of this nation over the last decade or so is not held hostage to non-pecuniary loss awards and wrongful death litigation in this state or in any other state. Juries aren't weeping big tears and giving away the farm. In the large verdicts and the very few of them that we've seen in this state, you can find great big areas of pecuniary loss, in other words, money damages. And those have been the basis of Alaska awards. There's no evidence whatsoever that changing the rules, as suggested here, will do anything but harm those people whose grief ought to be compensated and whose loss should be addressed. I might point out to the committee that in my years of handling these cases, I've never had a grieving individual come into my office and say, oh my God, my son or daughter is dead, my husband is gone, I need to recover the pecuniary loss to his estate. You know, that people are in your office over these cases because they are hurt, because they look for a source of redress, and because they expect society to acknowledge that which has struck them.